Now Elijah has many disciples who follow him in a kind of school of the prophets. The scriptures call it the company of the prophets. So it seems as though God's voice is being heard. All is not lost. In fact, it is going quite well. But Elijah senses that his time is drawing to a close. His work is done. One of the greatest prophets, then, must pass his mantle on to someone else. Now, Elisha can sense it as well. The other prophets can sense it. And Elisha will not let Elijah out of his sight, partly because he loves him, but also because he wants to be Elijah's successor. He wants to receive the double portion of Elijah's spirit. Perhaps as if to say, I am only half the man that you are. He will not depart. He will not leave Elijah without inheriting his spiritual father's birthright. As Elijah is making his final rounds, he and Elisha visit various places. Jericho, for example. Stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan, says Elijah. Elisha says, as the Lord lives, and you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they went on. Elijah strikes the Jordan with his mantle, his cloak, and the waters of the Jordan divide. Should remind you of Moses and his staff. Should remind you of Joshua, who both parted the waters. And Elijah's mantle is sort of like Moses' rod. Then the climax of the story, they cross the Jordan. And again, Elisha says, give me that double portion. And Elijah says, you've asked for a hard thing. But if you see me when I leave, you will receive the double portion. And you know how the story ends. The chariots of the heavens come. Elijah ascends somehow in a whirlwind. And Elisha finds the mantle, gets the double portion. And what we didn't read was, Elisha goes back to the Jordan, puts Elijah's mantle in the Jordan, and the waters part for him as well. Elisha has indeed inherited the double portion of Elijah's spirit. But think about these things. Elijah was a human being. What happened? Where'd he go? Up, somewhere. Elisha is also a human being, but his ministry was very similar, if not shorter. Signs accompanied him as well throughout his life. But even when Elisha died, signs were still accompanying him. Listen to these verses from 2 Kings 13. So Elisha died, and they buried him. Now bands of Moabites used to invade the land in spring of the year. As an Israelite man was being buried, a marauding band of Moabites was seen, and the man was thrown into the grave of Elisha. As soon as the man touched the bones of Elisha, what happened? He came back to life and stood on his feet. What is this about? So we have our gospel. The transfiguration is almost too much for words. And Mark, as Mark usually does, briefly, doesn't say a whole lot. But what he does say is very profound. Matthew, Mark, of course, Matthew and Luke also record the transfiguration. And Peter mentions it in his letters, as does John. Jesus is showing his divinity, but like I said, this transfiguration is just as much a revelation of true humanity. as it is Christ's deity. If you don't believe me, read what Paul says in 2 Corinthians. And then suddenly we have Moses and Elijah. Where did they come from? If the casting out of demons and the healing of the sick were not enough, this event clearly shows the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Jesus is the one who is ushering it in. But what do they say about us? What do they say about calling? This is where our favorite character, Peter, comes in. He's confused, he's afraid, and he attempts to build three shrines. Now, in the Gospels, if you read them carefully, Peter is the one who often represents everyone else. He represents us. We were just at his house last week. He witnessed the fame of Christ. All the city was there to see him. And Jesus says, no, let's go somewhere else. And Peter was forced to follow. But in Mark chapter 8, just before this one, it is Peter who says, you are the Christ, the Messiah. And yet, he cannot bear to see Christ go to the cross. And therefore, he is given the wonderful title of Satan. And of course, we will spend much time with Peter at the end of the story. Now, the Eastern Orthodox have always reflected on the transfiguration, not so much as Jesus changing, but as the disciples changing. Suddenly, the scales fall from their eyes, and they see what true reality is all about. It's as if their eyes were opened for the very first time, and they see what is real, and what they have been experiencing is not so real. Who can blame Peter for wanting to memorialize what is happening? Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Indeed, it is. The disciples were having what I believe it's St. Augustine said. They were having an eighth day experience. That is, our lives are our Sunday through Saturday, 7 days. But when you step out of that, it's an eighth day. It's out of the realm of what we are used to seeing and experiencing. The veil has been lifted, and we see reality for the first time. It's like I have been saying from Stephen Freeman's book, it's a one-storied universe full of God. Stephen Freeman writes, learning to live in a one-story universe means also learning to live in a world in which we ourselves are not the prisoners of time. The one who is to come is also the Lord who is present to us now, the same Lord who was before the beginning and who was slain for our salvation. In him, the church becomes a community that has a present time, but is also the community of the eschaton, that is, eternal time, the end of things, everything put together. The eighth day experience that the disciples are having shows that Pascha, Easter, goes backwards. Think about it. Moses died. Elisha and his bones. Easter, Pascha goes backwards and forwards, past and present. Because in Easter and Pascha there is no time. The transfiguration is an event of Chabad or Shekhinah, glory. It is also what we all are destined for. Not in the same way as Jesus, of course. But we all are made to be like him. Gregory of Nyssa wrote, "If you wash away the mud that has been put on your heart, the godlike beauty will again shine in you." But if only we could stay there. Peter and we are given another call. One that precedes glory. If Peter was surprised that Jesus could walk away from fame in Capernaum, what will happen when he sees what Jesus will do when he comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration and sets his eye and his heart on Jerusalem and the cross? A descent from glory and the eternal, where there is no boundary between the living and the dead, to the road to Jerusalem, to the way of suffering. Peter and the disciples needed that transfiguration experience so that they could remember, while walking with Jesus through the most difficult and shameful time in their lives. Lent affords us an opportunity, one to go deeper. Now, we all know that the Christian life is to be lived faithfully every day. But Lent is a time of importance because it is a time of focus. To focus on not what we are giving up, but ways that we can be more available to God. Ways we can listen more to who we are and to who God is. It is an invitation to focus on something so wonderfully countercultural. Who's going to tell you you're dust? And to dust you shall return, if not the church. Who's going to tell you that the hope of mankind, the hope of all humanity, is in a cross? Who's going to tell you that except the church? Who's going to remind us that, yes, we are sinners in need of God's grace and hope? Who's going to remind us of that except the church? Lent invites us to walk in a way that prepares the soil of our hearts to be ready for the fruits of God's Spirit. Christ calls us to walk humbly with him, to take his footsteps to the end of ourselves, to the cross. Amen.